the people of ancient Israel were led at different times in different forms. There were the patriarchs, there were judges, there were kings, there were prophets, there were priests. And the books of Samuel and Kings covers the time when Israel was ruled by kings, which is the monarchy. So today we're going to be looking at the period of time that covers the reign of King Solomon. That's 1 Kings chapters 1 to 11. We're going to look at 1 Kings in two parts, and then we're going to look at 2 Kings. The book of 1 and 2 Kings is originally one book. Of the various books of the Bible, these ones are history books. They largely just record the history. This is as opposed to prophecy books like Isaiah or poetry books like the Psalms. This is history. Now, the Bible is a collection of a variety of documents written by a range of people over thousands of years. But it isn't just a rambling story. It paints a coherent picture of the progression of God's plan. So to see where Solomon fits into the picture, we have to go back to Genesis chapter 12. Genesis 12 records a promise that God made to Abraham. He said, "I will make you into a great nation and I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." That promise was passed down through the patriarchs. It was Isaac and then Jacob. His name was changed to Israel. And the promise that all peoples on earth would be blessed through Abraham was ultimately to be fulfilled in his descendant Jesus, who brings reconciliation to God for anyone on earth who puts their trust in him and his sacrificial death and resurrection. In Egypt, the extended family of Israel transforms into a nation. Remember, they went down to Egypt as a family. They came out of Egypt as a nation. And after the people leave Egypt in dramatic fashion and later stop at Mount Sinai, God speaks through Moses and he makes a deal with them. And this is the deal. Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6. "If you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all the nations you will be my treasured possession." And he goes on, "You will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." This is the deal. And they agreed to it. So under God's direction and Joshua's leadership, the people take over a region of land and they carve out a physical nation. Eventually the people demand a king and God gives them Saul. But Saul's not very faithful to God. And eventually he's replaced by David, who is faithful to God. And in 1 Samuel chapter 7, verse 16, it's recorded how God makes David a promise. His promise was that your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. That was the promise that God made to David. And we'll talk about that a little bit again later. This promise about the throne being established forever, of course, would eventually be finally fulfilled in Jesus, who sits on the throne as the ruler of the kingdom of heaven forever. That's the ultimate fulfillment of that promise. Getting back to Jacob, Jacob had 12 sons who became the 12 tribes of Israel. And this bit about the 12 tribes is relevant to the account that we're going to cover today, because God took the kingdom away from Solomon's descendants. All of the kingdom, that is, except for the tribe of Judah. And hence we have this period of the divided kingdom. Under David and under Solomon, Israel was united, but after Solomon died, it was divided. So you have the united kingdom and the divided kingdom. During Solomon's time, the different tribes were geographically distinct, and the kingdom became split between the northern tribes and Judah, which is in the south. And the focus of God's plan remained primarily with Judah, however. The promise was passed down through there. The northern kingdom didn't disappear entirely, but to a certain extent, they ultimately actually became the Samaritans of Jesus' day. So after that rather lengthy introduction, what's the main point of the reign of King Solomon? What can we learn about this? Well, Solomon is a hinge point in the Bible. It's the beginning of a downward slide. And the reason is because of Solomon's idolatry. Solomon wasn't faithful to God. He wandered off into worshipping other gods, who are really best referred to as non-gods because they're not gods at all. Now, another word that's closely related to this word idolatry is syncretism, and that is the mixing of different religions and different religious practices, mixing the worship of God Yahweh with worship of non-gods. There was 1,000 years from Abraham to David, and David really was the pinnacle. And Solomon represents the peak in terms of national, economic, and political greatness for the nation. But everything went downhill after that. And the reason it went downhill was because of a lack of faithfulness to God. And it highlights how serious this is in God's eyes. Solomon was the hinge point. And the lesson from all of this is that God demands undivided allegiance. That's the message from all of this. God demands undivided allegiance. So the reign of Solomon. We're going to follow the trajectory of Solomon, focusing mainly on what God was recorded as saying and doing. So there's a transition of power. When David was old, one of his sons, on his own initiative, decided to take over the throne. But David had already decided that Solomon was going to succeed him. So David does a quick bit of manoeuvring and succeeded in putting Solomon on the throne. Then God grants wisdom to Solomon. Solomon historically is synonymous with wisdom. The wisdom of Solomon is a phrase. And chapter 3 describes how this comes about. We'll read that, chapter 3, verses 5 to 15. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream, and God said, "Ask for whatever you want me to give you." Solomon answered, "You have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You have continued this great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne this very day. Now, Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, but I am only a little child and do not know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you have chosen, a great people too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours?" The Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, "Since you have asked for this and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor have asked for the death of your enemies, but for discernment in administering justice, I will do what you have asked. I will give you a wise and discerning heart, so that there will never have been anyone like you, nor will there ever be. Moreover, I will give you what you have not asked for, both wealth and honor, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. And if you walk in obedience to me and keep my decrees and commands, as David your father did, I will give you a long life." Then Solomon awoke and he realized it had been a dream. This is a bit of an aside. There's a tradition that Solomon was a teenager at this time, but actually he wasn't. It seems he was speaking euphemistically when he refers to himself as being a child. But the point that we'd make out of this passage is that the splendour of Solomon's reign was the result of God's grace to Solomon. As you read the passages that describe his reign and the splendour of it, it's the most amazing thing. But it's important to remember that that came about as a result of God's grace to him. Then Solomon builds the temple. And you can read about that, chapter 5, Just a little bit of a side again, chapter 5, verse 13, we can see it's interesting that Solomon conscripted some labourers, but they had a pretty good shift roster, 1 month on and 2 months off. Not bad. Chapters 6 and 7 describe the temple. But in the middle of this description, there's a record of what God had to say to Solomon about this temple. So we can read in chapter 6, verses 11 to 13. The word of the Lord came to Solomon, "As for this temple you're building, if you follow my decrees, observe my laws, and keep all my commands and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father, and I will live among the Israelites and will not abandon my people Israel." So to God the temple is secondary. He says, as for this temple you're building, and then goes on to talk about other things. The main point of the discussion that he had with Solomon was what? It was about faithful obedience. It wasn't about the temple. It was about faithful obedience. God had made a promise to David that I read before, and that promise would be fulfilled. What was in question was who it would be fulfilled through. Later on, when the temple's completed and ceremonially put into service, the glory of the Lord in the form of a cloud filled the temple, the same as the cloud of the glory of God described in Exodus, you remember. Now, except for a vision described in Ezekiel, this is the last time that the glory of God is described as appearing in this way. But it's a most dramatic scene, this dedication of the temple. In chapter 9, God reiterates his deal with Solomon. Chapter 9, verses 1 to 9. When Solomon had finished building the temple of the Lord and the royal palace, and had achieved all that he had desired to do, the Lord appeared to him a second time, as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. The Lord said to him, "I have heard the prayer and plea you have made before me. I have consecrated the temple which you have built. By putting my name there forever, my eyes and my heart will always be there. As for you, if you walk before me faithfully with integrity of heart and uprightness, as David your father did, and do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father when I said, 'You shall never fail to have a successor on the throne of Israel.' But if you or your descendants turn away from me and do not observe the commands and decrees I have given you, and go off to serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I have given them, and I will reject this temple I have consecrated for my name. Israel will then become a byword and an object of ridicule among all the people. This temple will become a heap of rubble. All who pass by will be appalled and will scoff and say, 'Why has the Lord done such a thing to this land and to this temple?' People will answer, 'Because they have forsaken the Lord their God, who brought their ancestors out of Egypt, and have embraced other gods, worshipping and serving them. That is why the Lord brought all this disaster on them.'" Now, unfortunately, Solomon and the people didn't keep their part of the bargain, and that punishment that God foretold is eventually what came to pass. But it's important to remember that it all happened on a time scale that actually makes it easy for people at the time, on the day, to dismiss or to forget that this is what God has said would happen. God is the God of history, and his plans play out over the span of history, not the span of recollection of a human lifetime. So to see the plans of God, you really have to look at the span of the whole history. And we're privileged to be able to do that by reading these histories that are recorded in the scriptures. So God made this deal. The people had certain obligations. God said, if you do this, this is what happens. If you don't do this, then this will be the result. Let's have a closer look at this covenant. So with David, the covenant was unconditional. There was no if or then. He said, your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. There was no if or then. It was unconditional. And yet, when God's speaking to Solomon, he says this in verse 4, as for you, if you walk before me, so if you walk before me with integrity of heart and uprightness as you have, as David your father did, and do all I command and observe my decrees and laws, I will establish your throne over Israel forever. And so on it goes. So David was faithful to God. And God knew that David would continue to be faithful to him, in spite of other things that he did wrong. So David received an unconditional promise. For Solomon, however, there would always be a descendant of David on the throne, but that's not the same as saying that there would always be a descendant of Solomon on the throne. Solomon goes off the rails. A few of the men of the Old Testament seem to get themselves into trouble through exercising poor judgment in relation to women. And Solomon was the classic. And the text is fairly self-explanatory, chapter 11, verses 1 to 13. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. They were from nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, you must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Moloch, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Moloch, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives, who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. There's a lot in all of that. It says that the Lord became angry with Solomon, and this is the hinge point of the story of Solomon's rule, and in fact the whole political history of Israel. For all his sins, as I said, remember David broke 5 of the 10 commandments, did some pretty serious things wrong. But for all of those things, he was not guilty of idolatry as Solomon was. He didn't go after worshipping other gods. Note, just to emphasise the point, that it wasn't that the women were foreign that was the problem, but that they worshipped foreign gods. Ruth was the great-grandmother of David, and she was a foreigner. She was a Moabite. Okay. The difference was that Ruth chose to give up the gods of her own family and devote herself to the god of her mother-in-law, Yahweh, the god of the Israelites. So, message for young Christians in this: don't ever consider marrying somebody of a different religion. Chances are it will get you into trouble with God. Solomon was a powerful and successful king, but even that didn't make him immune from the temptation to rationalize away expediency to keep other people happy. God executes judgment on Solomon So the end result of Solomon's unfaithfulness was this. Chapter 11, verses 29 to 40. About that time, Jeroboam was going out of Jerusalem, and Ahijah the prophet of Shiloh met him on the way, wearing a new cloak. The two of them were alone out in the country, and Ahijah took hold of the new cloak he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Then he said to Jeroboam, "Take 10 pieces for yourself, for this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. See, I am going to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hand and give you 10 tribes. But for the sake of my servant David and the city of Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, he will have one tribe. I will do this because they have forsaken me and have worshipped Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and Moloch, the god of the Ammonites, and have not walked in obedience to me, nor done what is right in my eyes, nor kept my decrees and laws as David, Solomon's father, did. But I will not take the whole kingdom out of Solomon's hand. I have made him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David, my servant, whom I chose and who obeyed my commands and decrees. I will take the kingdom from his son's hands and give you 10 tribes. I will give one tribe to his son so that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I chose to put my name. However, as for you, I will take you, and you will rule over all that your heart desires. You will be king over Israel. If you do whatever I command you and walk in obedience to me and do what is right in my eyes by obeying my decrees and commands, as David my servant did, I will be with you. I will build you a dynasty as enduring as the one I built for David and will give Israel to you. I will humble David's descendants because of this, but not forever." Solomon tried to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam fled to Egypt to Shishak the king and stayed there until Solomon's death. This is where we get to the end of Solomon's reign. Theology and history in the Bible are inseparable. They're really just one and the same thing. The fortunes of the nation are dependent on their faithfulness or otherwise to the covenant that they have with their God. That's what determines the trajectory, the path. So 1 Kings chapter 1 to 11 is both the peak politically, but it's also the beginning of this downward slide that's led by the unfaithfulness of Israel's leaders. In Deuteronomy 18, verse 9, it's recorded how God called his people to be separate, to be devoted to him. He said, "When you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you, do not learn to imitate the detestable ways of the nations there." And this is a repeated theme. The nation is the people of God, Yahweh, and they're expected to keep the law of Yahweh, particularly the purity of worship. That was the particular focus. There were blessings if they did and curses if they didn't. And the king stands as representative and leader of the nation. And as such, the history of the nation is recounted, mainly by recounting the kings. So that's how we get the history of ancient Israel, is this recount of the reign of the succession of kings. That's the focus. They are the leaders, and they determine the path of the nation's history. So Solomon was king as representative of God's nation, and he failed to be faithful to God, who had created the nation. In his later life, he began to imitate the detestable worship of the surrounding nations, that exact thing that God had said not to do. Now, if you remember back to Judges, in Judges there's all sorts of heinous crimes going on, really dreadful stuff. But the one thing that God really tore into the people for was idolatry, a worship that wasn't worship of God. That's really what he got stuck into the people for, over and above all of the other really dreadful things that were going on. Now, in contrast, when we look at the absolute splendour of Solomon's reign, it's important not to idealise Solomon. Unlike in the book of Judges, everything seems to be all sweetness and light, and all wonderful and successful. Yet contrasted against this great splendour is this spiritual deterioration, degeneration into idolatry. And this idolatry, this worship that wasn't worship of God, it was just as serious as it was during the time of Judges. Because that's what's important to God. So the takeaway, what do we take away from all of this? Well, I'd put this challenge. Have you given your full allegiance to God? Stop now and ask yourself that question. Have you given your full allegiance to God? With God, you can't be half in and half out. You can't be only half committed to God. Either he is Lord of all, or he is not Lord at all. Now, even though God expects his people to behave responsibly, like adults, as opposed to children, he knows that you can't be perfect. But above all, he expects you to be faithful to him. Jesus is the only way to God, and acknowledging Jesus while still giving credence to other religious practices and pathways is not acceptable to God, no matter what the rest of the world might think. Political correctness doesn't cut it with God. God will accept nothing less than submission to his son Jesus. And in return, he promises to forgive, to forget, and to overlook our failings that otherwise separate us from him. He promises eternity with him in his perfect everlasting kingdom. Let's pray. Dear Heavenly Father, we do thank you that you sent your Son Jesus, and that through him we can be reconciled to you.